Welcome to the Sum of It All, Cultivating Mathematical Hearts podcast. I'm Audrey Mendeville, along with my colleague Mark Alcorn from the San Diego County Office of Education. And this season, we're diving into the book, Cultivating Mathematical Hearts, Culturally Responsive Mathematics Teaching in Elementary Classrooms by Maria del Rosario Zavala and Julia Maria Aguirre. Transcripts to our podcasts are always available for you in the episode notes on your favorite platform. This week, we are diving into Chapter 4, Rigor and Support.
Such a great title. And Audrey, I'm going to just start straight from the words of the authors on page 60. And here's what they have to say. This strand is all about how learners are moved from the margin to the center with strategic scaffolds that maintain high cognitive demand while viewing their linguistic identities as assets rather than deficits in the mathematics classroom. And Audrey, the reason I wanted to start with that quote as we get into our conversation is that this is just such a nice summary of the rest of the chapter. I really appreciate their emphasis around high cognitive demand. And unfortunately, it's often the first thing that's removed when we support students at the margins.
Yeah, Mark, I really appreciate that. And I'm looking forward to our conversations more about that throughout this chapter. You know, this chapter starts with a vignette story of Alicia, a teacher in the classroom who is struggling with how much help to support her students with. And it reminded me a lot of the work of a Hungarian-born psychologist, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who in the early 1970s began to discuss the idea of an optimal experience, which later turned into his study of the work on an idea he called flow, which is the balance between like how challenging something is and how able someone feels to tackle that challenge. And there's a nice summary of this in Building Thinking Classrooms in Chapter 9. You can listen back to Season 1 for that Episode 9 on that, or you can check out that book or look up his work. It's super interesting. But finding the space for all of our students to be in that flow where they're staying away from boredom on one side and they're staying away from frustration on the other side, and they're staying right in that sweet spot, that optimal experience, that seems to be what Alicia is describing in this vignette. And I think it's something that every teacher has felt, like, how much should I help and how much is just too much?
Yeah, Audrey, that is such the dilemma, right? That's the real question. And I'm also wondering, like, how much does our bias play into that decision about how much help is too much help?
Yeah, it's an ongoing question. It's not something that I think any teacher's immune to. I think we all fall into it in different points. We're like, oh, I gave them too much help there. Or
you can
see the frustration start to build. And you're like, if I had just done a little bit more, maybe I could have, you know, staved off the frustration a little bit longer. So this chapter says we have three things that have a positive impact on mathematics success. And they talk about that being the strong family, school, and teacher-student relationships, the high quality content, and the high expectations. And we need to have all three of these woven together. So I'm super excited about our conversations today. So to start with, first dimension we need to dive into, and this one is one we've definitely had some toe dipping into the waters of this before, a sustaining high cognitive demand. What'd you think?
Well, Audrey, again, maybe like we did at last episode, let's start with those essential questions that guide us into each of these dimensions. And here's the one that goes with high cognitive demand. How does my lesson enable all my students to closely explore and analyze math concepts, procedures, and problem-solving and reasoning strategies? You know what this reminds me of, Audrey, is the idea that it's more than just the task that we choose. It's also about how we implement the task. And do you remember the TIMSS studies that came out years ago?
Yeah.
And I know when I believe I was in my master's program when I first learned about those studies. And the thing that really struck me about that is that when they looked across the world at the different countries they were using in their study, they found that the math tasks themselves didn't vary widely in terms of the level of cognitive demand. But they found something very interesting in the United States. They found at that time anyway, when they did this study, they found that the actual way that the task was implemented was much different. They found that the teachers actually ended up lowering the cognitive demand of the task with the type of supports that they were over-supporting and giving to their students. So I thought that was so interesting that the tasks were similar, but yet this over-supporting was going on in the United States. And our authors bring up that idea of that Smith and Stein cognitive demand matrix that you and I have mentioned before in multiple seasons of this podcast, and how it's just been really helpful in our work to sort of look at a task and say, what level of demand does this task have? And then, of course, keeping in mind the implementation of the task. You know what might be helpful for our listeners is maybe we'll link that Smith and Stein cognitive demand matrix in our show notes, Audrey, just to make sure people have access to that. Audrey, just one other quote I'll just mention. And then I'm very curious to see what you have to say about this kind of stuff is the quote is, how can we expect students to be successful in high cognitive demand tasks if we never give them the opportunity to engage in those tasks? And that's page 65.
Yeah, you brought up so many wonderful things to talk about, you know, and I think that the tension or the intertwining maybe is a better word of both the task and how it's implemented are kind of woven throughout the dimensions in this section. And so I think we'll see a little bit more of that in the next dimension too, but I appreciate you really thinking about the cognitive demand piece and how, like, if we don't have high cognitive demand stuff in front of our kids, how do we think they're ever going to learn to engage in it? So the quote that like takes my breath away when I read it in this section was that Black and Brown children from working class communities have the least access to challenging, engaging mathematics. And so when you think about the quote you just read, that means they have the least access to opportunities to engage in those tasks, which means they have the least opportunity to engage in mathematics, which means, right? Like right. We're on a downward spiral here,
yeah.
And it's our own doing of our system. Mm. In some approaches, they continue, children are given mathematics activities that are entirely different from the work of their peers in the name of meeting them where they are. Now, I have heard this so many times, right?
Right.
And you know, the authors describe this. They say, okay, some of the kids got skills worksheets to help them fill in gaps and things, and other students are ready for the problem solving. They got problem solving. And it's based on this approach or this idea that you have to master, you know, your skills before you can engage in complex problem solving. And I love this line. I highlighted it in three colors. While this view is outdated, it is nonetheless common. And it's not because I'm thrilled that it's common, but it's because I'm reminding it is an outdated view. And the authors come back several times to say, there's no reason you cannot learn your skills through complex problem solving. You can do the problem solving and the complex cognitive demand first and gain all those other things through that process. And that was just super encouraging for me to remember and to have that out in this text that centers our most marginalized students.
I really appreciate that point, Audrey. It's so important because that road of only skills, I'm going to just call it a road to nowhere, because if our most vulnerable students are pulled away from each opportunity of the interesting problem tasks, the ones at the high cognitive demand, to work on these isolated low-level skills, when do they get a chance to be better at problem solving?
Yeah, that is the question. So let's talk about what high cognitive demand tasks look and sound like. I think the Smith and Stein matrix is a good space to start. It has bullet points that help you understand, like, if you have a high quality task. But I also really appreciate what they say, that the high cognitive demand tasks require students to draw on community, situational, and other kinds of knowledge as they work through the task. They are drawing on all their funds of knowledge. And I so appreciate that. Like, this is a multidimensional thing we're talking about here. This is not just, we finished studying X concept in my textbook. Now I have a word problem about it. And, you know, and they talk about like how cognitive demand is about creating opportunities for students to engage in sense making, connect mathematical ideas, and do the hefty mathematical work themselves. So I appreciate those like descriptors as maybe additional things I would write in on my Smith and Stein matrix to remind myself, like, are my kids doing that, right? Are my kids doing the hefty mathematical work? I just love that idea.
Yeah, I mean, if problem solving is the goal, then we should gear our just-in-time supports toward our students accessing the art of problem solving. And I just really think we just have to wake up and realize that no amount of practice with multiplication facts is going to improve a student's problem solving in and of itself.
Yeah, I'm totally with you, Mark. I think those kinds of problems just help our students to be able to do those kinds of problems. And that's what the quote in on page 63 talks about, that the research suggests repetition just helps us to do repeated tasks. And so when we want our students to be able to do things beyond that, they're not prepared for it. And this is a bigger problem than just worksheets going out. I mean, there are materials that are very narrow in their view of mathematics, that are highly procedural, highly built on memorization, highly scripted direct instruction, and it's marketed to specific communities. And that's part of what the authors write about. And if that's true, then those communities of students are only learning to do a very narrow kind of mathematics. And that's, they're not learning the beauty of it. They're not learning how to reason with it. And they're certainly not getting the cognitive demand that we're talking about in this section.
Yeah, great points, Audrey. I really like how you summarized that piece. As we go a little further into the chapter, Audrey, I was really reflecting on the bottom of 65 and how they're, you know, really considering how we make sure kids have access to the mathematics and making sure there's not barriers of language and other things that are unnecessary. And it made me remember a phrase that I don't remember where I stole it from, but here it is that we want the mathematics to be problematic, not the problem to be problematic. We want the cognitive demand for kids to have the quickest path into the messiness and the struggle, the productive struggle of the mathematics versus the problem itself.
I love that phrase. You know, they talk about like the length of the problem does not measure its cognitive demand. And right. I think that's important. I think especially secondary teachers, the folks think that it has to be a word problem for it to have high cognitive demand. It's like, no friends, like there's all kinds of problems that have high cognitive demand, and it doesn't have to be insanely, you know, worded in a convoluted way. That's like you just said, it's problematic in and of itself. And that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to have something that's mathematically problem solving and interesting for students. Yep. And again, you know, they go on and they talk about ways that we can find these or develop these for our students. They talk about mathematical modeling is one way to get high cognitive tasks, mathematizing their real world routines. And then they talk about this idea of problem posers. What do you think about that?
Oh, and you know, Audrey, I know we said this last episode, but our authors just have just a wondrous way with language, how they explain this. And so I'm just going to share what they have on 66 around problem posers. They say that they also learn, meaning students, they also learn that their ideas are important and they can be generators of mathematical questions. Like when they engage in an environment that is like this, the byproducts are just huge, right?
Yeah, totally. So much here. There was a map that they could analyze that I think we both thought was an amazing idea. They had a twist of like a notice, wonder, and connect. And then they had this idea of an activity about learning to let go that I thought was interesting. Someone recently told me that everything in teacher education and credentialing and even the early years of teaching is all about maintaining control for teachers. Like it's all about classroom discipline. And this text is really offering something different and about your classroom. It's not about controlling students. It's not about keeping them quiet in their seats, but it's learning to let go in the right ways. And I know it's tricky. I know it's necessary. But the steps there I thought were super interesting to consider as well.
Yeah, I think the thing that really struck me in this section after I read it is really the connection to universal design for learning. Mm-hmm. And how when we center our most marginalized students and we consider what would be best for them and providing that to all of our students, I just think that that is just was a when I came to that realization a while back, that just really opened up a lot of possibility in terms of how we do this work.
So the next dimension is scaffolding up, which is really intertwined with this one we just talked about. And I love your idea of sharing the essential questions. You want to start us off again with the essential question, Mark?
Of course. The essential question is, how does my lesson maintain high rigor with high support for all students?
I love that, because the first thing I think about with scaffolding is how so often it looks like watering down stuff. And the author stated up right off the bat, say, students' needs are often equated with students' inabilities to do the math. And this is just such a deficit view of what's going on instead of really thinking about what scaffolding could be.
Yeah, I think this is a really important section, Audrey, in this chapter. On page 75, our authors say that scaffolding should be a tool to support student access to and engagement with mathematics, not a bunch of construction debris that blocks entry to the mathematical ideas. I just thought it was so cool how they brought the construction analogy into the space, right? I don't think I've ever seen that done before. I also wonder a little bit, and I'm going to keep my elementary math hat on for a second here, is that I wonder if there's some pedagogical differences between introducing literacy concepts to students versus introducing math concepts to students. And I wonder if there can be some discrepancies around what the purpose of scaffolding is in the moment in literacy versus mathematics. And for generalists that are teaching all these content areas, I wonder if there could be some decisions that just we don't always sort of consider the pedagogy of the content area we're teaching. So I'm kind of wondering about that a little bit. The other thing I wanted to mention is later the authors mentioned the distinction between preparing our students to productively engage in complex math tests versus over-controlling the mathematical thinking and engagement. And it kind of goes back to what you were talking about before, which is this idea of control and how much of that is seeping into the way that we're running mathematics. And finally, Audrey, one other point. You know, they had this section called back pocket. Did you notice that?
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
And the idea of this back pocket section, I'm calling it the back pocket section. Maybe our listeners can find that header so they can see what I'm talking about. But the thing that was kind of cool about it is it's this idea of like having these scaffolds, these ideas to support students in your back pocket. And the thing I thought was really cool about this is different than overly supporting on the front end of things. I don't know about you, Audrey, but like a lot of times I have to say I erred on the side of over preparing my students before I cut them loose, because it's like, I need to make sure you're completely ready to do whatever I'm going to ask you to do. But I think what's important to think about is that scaffold I might give may not even be needed. And I'm sort of robbing my students of the brilliance that they were about to show me. And maybe another way to say this, Audrey, is like, I want to put myself in a position as a teacher so my students surprise me. They surprise me with the ideas they come up with. But having those scaffolds in my back pocket allowing to make sure that I'm supporting my students, but maybe not pushing them ahead, the scaffolds ahead of where there may not be needed.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mark. You know, having them ready to go instead of just having them there. I think that's one of the reasons we accidentally over scaffold is we just throw everything in the mix to begin with. And there's some ideas about why we over scaffold given at the bottom of page 75. I'd add that for secondary teachers, pacing guides and getting through the curriculum and control are also big factors of why they over scaffold is feeling like we don't have time for you not to get this today. I only have a day set aside for this lesson and you've got to get it today. And so I'm going to keep scaffolding until you get it. But I also, you know, I appreciated that in the elementary, you know, teacher's lens, it talks about also maybe a fear of what students might ask. Letting go of control a little bit and not over scaffolding, and that the teacher might not know. And, you know, I think that's actually a fear that secondary teachers have too. And I think it's a little bit about both that someone might, a student might recognize that a teacher didn't know this, which is highly tied into a secondary math teacher's identity, but also that we've created a system where teachers are the mathematical authority. And so until we really believe that the mathematical authority rests with the whole class, all of the students in the class, that's a really, it feels like a very dangerous place. And so I think we over-scaffold sometimes to make sure that kids go down a very specific path that does not lead to any alternatives. But you know, your discussion of the back pocket reminds me so much of Julie Dixon. She talks a lot about the just in time versus the just in case, right? So so it's oftentimes we have, oh, I put in all these extra helps just in case you need them. And it's like, nope, don't do that. You're over scaffolding. Have them ready just in time. Have them in your back pocket, which I think is the analogy these authors are making.
Yeah, and I just appreciate, Audrey, that the authors are putting us in this position of tension to really consider like providing enough scaffolding while also trusting our children as sense makers.
Yeah. So then there has to come a time though, if you've scaffolded, that you have to remove the scaffolding, right? And I really appreciated their attention here because I think the notion most of us have around that is that means you are ripping away one by one all of the supports you have ever given, right? And the authors present it as a much more tenuous situation than that. What do you think?
Well, it's funny you say that, Audrey, because as I was reading and we're going through this whole idea of scaffolds, I saw manipulatives were coming up. And I said to myself, I wonder how they're going to handle this. I have to say, I was a little bit worried because I thought it was going to be kind of one of these things where the manipulatives were going to be a scaffold and then we take away that scaffold. But of course, our authors came through with just this really eloquent way of explaining the idea of scaffolds and how that this idea, and I'll use their words, they take a broad perspective on what it means to remove scaffolding. And the other thing they mentioned that the scaffold is not necessarily a means to an end. So for example, with manipulatives, that can be a scaffold in terms of helping students make meaning of a particular math concept. But it's not, that doesn't just where it stops. It's also a means of communicating one's thinking, and that can be continued to be used over time. So it's not like that manipulative goes away. So boy, our authors just really, the way they wrote about that, Audrey, I had not even seen that written that way before around manipulatives. And boy, I'm going to definitely save that for sharing that with others.
Yeah, it was very, very appreciated. So we're down to our last dimension in this one, which is affirming multiculturalism. And the authors reference one of the books we've actually read in a previous season, back to season 7, which was Teaching Math to Multilingual Learners by Catherine Chabal. And there are so many great points in this section of the text on this, and there's so much overlap too. So if you haven't had a chance, that's definitely a season to listen back to.
Oh, for sure. And Audrey, maybe I'll read the essential question for this section here. And it says, how does my lesson make space for multilingual learners to be central participants in mathematics activities?
I really appreciate that part because I think two of the things that the authors are mentioning is one, power imbalances permeate a classroom. Always. They're super, they just write it out there. And that without attention to it, multilingualism is always a marginalized identity. Instead, we need to really pay attention and move it to the center. And the other piece is they talk about positioning, and they talk about how teachers have to use their role to position students, because when we choose to do nothing, we are actually still positioning students and we don't even realize it. And so we have to take an active stance in that. And I really appreciated those two things right off the bat.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing up the idea of positioning. And it makes me think of this idea also of status in terms of how students look at each other in terms of their status in the classroom. And it reminds me of Peter Lilliedahl's Building Thinking Classrooms, and one of those strategies being the visibly random groups, and how that strategy itself can over time chip away this idea of status and allowing students to see the brilliance of their classmates. What I started wondering about in terms of as we were reading this book is wondering about this notion of strategic groupings versus that practice of random groupings, and thinking about how each of them have their advantages in different situations. So, for example, I'm thinking like the brilliance of a multilingual student who is at the emergent stage of speaking English, and how that how a student who happens to speak that same primary language might be able to communicate with that student, which would allow the high cognitive demand of the task to be able to maintain, because both of those students could be conversing at that level that we're expecting around the mathematics. And that conversation can happen in both of their students' primary language. And just kind of wondering about that in terms of considering the randomized groups versus a strategic grouping where that primary language could be leveraged as an asset.
Sounds like we need to, at some point, just pick these authors' brains a little bit more, because they have so many ideas to share, but definitely left us wondering about some more things, didn't it?
Oh, for sure.
There were so many ideas in this section that we could share. I think one last one that's worthy of me mentioning is the reminder about having students write in mathematics. I know we talked about it briefly last episode, so I'm not going to harp on it for long again, but just that's not something we often spend time on in our classes, but doing so actually is beneficial to our multilingual learners, and it's beneficial to our students in so many ways. And so I appreciate them calling that out again.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I'm actually looking forward to the translanguaging example in Chapter 8 that they gave us a little teaser for. So looking forward to that, Audrey.
Yes, me too.
Well, thanks for joining us for this episode. In our next episode, we will chat about Chapter 5, Power and Participation. Until then, best wishes in cultivating joy and justice in the mathematics classroom.